pack your knives, and stay. Yes, stay for the Top Chef Judges Table podcast here at robhasawebsite.com. I'm Antonio Mazzaro, but it doesn't really matter who I am because I'm judged by the company I keep. And in this case, it's Mike Bloom, Kurt Clark, and Josh Wigler. How is everybody? Josh, what's wrong?
I just have no joy anymore.
Oh, boy. Are we gonna say soy vey to your situation, Josh?
I have lost all the joy in podcasting.
Oh, Josh, you have to find it again.
I left my podcast 2 months ago called The Survivor Know-It-Alls, and I just haven't been the same ever since.
The Survivor Squid Meatballs?
The Survivor Squid It Alls.
I wouldn't be surprised if that ends up on a gross food challenge someday, specifically Jason's squid meatballs.
I love that we're still on that.
Ooh, so gross, though. I don't know.
So gross. No, I'm great. I'm fantastic. I'm excited to be here, guys. 2 weeks in a row. Maybe I'll stay here for the rest of the time. Who knows?
We'd love to have you.
This is great. This is a great sequence, Josh. Only six more other co-hosts you have to defeat before you can make it to the final.
Yeah.
And several more possible kitchen fires.
Yeah. Listen, I'm hopeful there will be no fires in this podcast. There is a blizzard outside my window today, so I am battling the elements once again.
Yeah, Mike, how's it where you are? You're right in the same area as Josh there. 2 feet of snow?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely piling up there, so I'm happy to be talking about some hot food here today. It'll definitely warm my heart a bit from the cold outside.
What's the best snow-related food you can make? Is it just snow cream? Is that the go-to? Kurt, do you have any Chicago snow recipes?
That actually involved the snow as the secret ingredient?
Yeah, snow is a featured ingredient in your ingredient box.
You know, I think you just got to get some, like, Tirani syrup, some snow, and just go to town on a homemade snow cone.
I think that's the move. Gourmet snow cone.
Yeah, but make sure the snow is from a protected, pristine area. That's all I'm going to say.
Uh-huh. There's dogs right over there. It's gross. Yeah.
No, that Philip would definitely incorporate yellow snow into one of his dishes.
Yeah. It's yummy. It's yummy. My yummy yellow snow.
It's authentic. Oh. I've played it on a frozen something. I can't even tell what this is. Yeah. It's just gross. Yeah. Well, yeah, it's snowing out there. Hopefully people can keep their heads above the snow. This is a little ridiculous. 2 feet. I mean, that's like tiny human size. So if you have any children, I'd say don't let them outside because they might not be able to get their head over where they need to walk. This is bad news. It's illegal to go outside in New York right now, guys.
Yeah.
I don't know, Mike, did you get the alert on your phone?
Yep, we got like semblances of the alert, and then we got the actual alert of like non-emergency vehicles have to be off the road, and then I think after that the travel ban got instituted, and they actually have shut down Broadway, which is a big rarity as well. So you can tell this is top five baby storms in New York history at this point.
And yet I am reading that SNL will go on as planned.
Oh boy.
Well, yeah.
Well, they survived an hour-long delay last week. I think they can survive a snowstorm this time.
The universe is conspiring against SNL.
Yeah, they should be fine because Ronda Rousey's there, too. And, I mean, I think she could just kick the crap out of anybody trying to show up.
I thought you were going to say she's going to chokehold the blizzard.
She's going to choke Jonas to death.
Yeah.
Mother Nature.
He's going to make some nice sushi and everything.
Oh, Antonio, this sounds so familiar.
Yes, the snowness jokes are back. This is fine. This is great. I'm happy. No, I think this is terrible. They're shutting down Broadway, Mike. Is no one going to see Hamilton tonight?
Apparently, the cancellation line for Hamilton is around the block. So I think people, like, if you want to find a more dedicated group of Broadway fans, I don't think you can find any more than Hamilton. Though there actually is a Broadway con, the first ever in town, and people are still holed up in a hotel doing that as well. So I'm waiting for the snow to pile up and they get snowed in and they result to like Donner Party techniques of eating the cast of Rent in order to subsist.
I was just about to say, if there was a Donner Party musical right now and there's a line out in the snow, that would be nicely poetic.
Well, I mean, if Sweeney Todd came back, I feel like it'd be really appropriate in this moment.
There's got to be a Donner Party off Broadway musical somewhere.
Kurt, if not, I think you should write it, my friend.
Okay, I'll get on that.
What would the show-stopping number of that musical be called? Any suggestions?
Gosh, I mean, so washing down my sister. I don't know.
I'm out.
That was worth the wait. It was worth the wait.
It's great to come back for a second podcast for 5 minutes, but now I'm done. I'm fine.
No, sometimes you have to drown your sorrows, Josh. I mean, look, at the beginning of this episode, Jeremy really missed his buddy Wesley. So sad.
It's true. Yeah. Everybody's.
It is, I mean, true.
This was one of the first times, I think, where we saw people, like, were actually, I want to say affected, but, like, there was a lot of impact in terms of he was a good chef and now he's gone. I think that's really kind of the first time we've had that true sentiment expressed this season.
True sentiment. I see what you did there because it's his last name.
Oh, Corcino sentiment. Yeah, this is too bad. I think you're right. We've passed sort of a point in the season, I think, where the tipping point is headed in the other direction. And I think some chefs are starting to find their footing. Of course, that was the story of Karen last episode. Carries over a little bit into this episode when Karen is talking about how she's feeling better, starting to find her stride. This is a very common thing that we've seen in previous seasons, Top Chefs, where some chefs really just hit a stride somewhere around this point in the season where they're able to compare themselves more favorably to the other chefs that are remaining and realize that they can cook. They can work their way through this competition. So that's happening for certain people. Others are caught up, I think. Kwame is apparently caught up with his crush on Padma. He wants to buy her a dog. Josh, is this a good move?
I think Kwame, I love this guy. He's so complicated. He has his daddy issues. He's horn dogging after every warm blooded woman on this show. He was it last week or 2 weeks ago where he was just all in on Chrissy Teigen. Yeah. He's got his crazy Padma crush. He's the most complicated character on the show, for sure.
And I have to say, I have to give two thumbs up to Kwame because I also bought my wife a Yorkie as a present. So I wholeheartedly agree with the gift. As long as Padma can handle housebreaking, I think it's a good choice.
I don't think Padma would be the greatest dog trainer. Something tells me that it wouldn't go very well.
Why? Where's that coming from?
I just feel like, shaming. Is shaming a big thing you do with dogs? Is that what you're supposed to do?
Right? Because you say no. Don't. Well, bad dog.
Sometimes we've actually been taking our dog to puppy classes and they say that sometimes with some exercises, negative attention is still attention. So sometimes the best way is to just sort of ignore the action. So we don't want to shame her too much, but now I feel that we pamper her. It's a delicate balance like any form of parenting is.
Are you
Go ahead.
Are you describing how you treat the dog or how people should treat Philip?
It's one and the same. He is sort of a hurt puppy by the end of this. And we saw a momentary kind of change in Philip's demeanor last episode when he's I'm just going to focus on cooking technically good food. And he did pretty well in the quick fire. And then Elimination Challenge, the old Philip just came back, including sort of disagreeing with former Top Chef winner Michael Voltaggio for his dish, which is just textbook Philip. So, we'll talk about the elimination lineup. And I was a little surprised to not see him go, but if this is one step closer getting to our goal of Philip making restaurant wars, I guess it's all worth it.
Yeah, this is the headline for sure, that Philip's got one more episode to go before restaurant wars. Unfortunately, I think if Philip turns to his left and turns to his right and looks around, he's got to be looking at himself as the likely boot next episode. So,
oh no, no, he has no idea that he's the likely boot.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, that's what I said. He completely lacks that awareness.
He has to actually look around in order.
Yeah,
that is true. Instead of looking straight ahead myopically at some pile of grass that he wants to smoke into the first dish. But yeah, this is tough. It's tough. The headline, the news of the day, of course, besides that, is that Chef Jason is sent home. Jason really was seeming to struggle. Josh, as you point out, the joy is gone from Jason and Jason's food. Were you surprised to see Jason go home this week?
No, we were talking about it last week with the soft on soft thing and just the grossness of that. And, the way that he's kind of looking at food, it's just not something that the judges were not picking up what he was putting down. They were, because it's their job to pick up what he's putting down and to eat it, but they were not happy with what they were eating. It was not yummy food. They were not fans of soft on soft. And we said last week that it was going to be difficult for him to win this thing. He could survive a little while longer, but his core cuisine is just not something that these people were responding to. So am I surprised to see him go this week? Definitely not. I think that it was only a matter of time, maybe a little surprised that it was quite so quick. But he, the joy was gone. There was no joy and they just did not like what he was doing.
Yeah, when he said poached fish, I was like, oh no, that's not exciting.
And this elimination challenge was really interesting in a myriad of ways. And one of them was when you look back at yourself 10 years ago, the contestants decide to determine that these are not necessarily need to be good memories. And in Jason's case, it was, I'm going to cook this fish to remind myself of how bitchy I was to everybody when I used to be the manager of a restaurant, which, as they talked about with Kwame, when you put bad emotions into a dish, I feel like you're going to get a bad product at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think that's a really good observation. I don't know. We'll definitely talk about the different inspirations that the chef testants drew from in order to cook their 10-year memory dish. But that was not a good place to start, I don't think. Is cooking what he described as a technically incredibly difficult dish and cooking it from a place of negativity. Two strikes against him when he stepped up to the plate. So difficult for Chef Jason. Any other eulogies for Chef Jason before we get into the show?
I like that he became the celery man in this episode.
Yeah, Jason had a lot of focus this episode, and it is interesting. We talked a little while ago when we first saw the Top Chef sausage stew and the emergence of the Bro Alliance that Jason had been feeling left out. We got a little bit more this episode, including, I guess I didn't realize it until now, but Jason does wear a lot of like clashing patterns and weird sort of Crocs in the kitchen, though I just sort of assumed that was the Pacific Northwest in a nutshell in terms of fashion sense. But yeah, I mean, he just never seemed to fit in. And I don't know, I'm pretty sure that didn't come out in his food in terms of a social aspect, but it's interesting that we kind of got that storyline coming back after the whole him calling out Philip a couple episodes ago.
You know, for me, honestly, the whole bro thing feels a little forced to me. Because if you look at the rest of the group, if you look at Kwame and Amar and Philip, yeah, there's and even Chad, the Jeremy is the only kind of bro vibe that I'm getting from anybody. Like, I think he just maybe doesn't necessarily fit in. I think him characterizing the rest of the group as bros really just hasn't sat right with me for the past few weeks in terms of accuracy.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is interesting. We'll talk about what happens with Chad in this episode, because I feel like maybe it's more of a party kind of just be silly kind of vibe that is out there. Yeah. And maybe Jason's more at a point in his life, admittedly, where he talks about how he's really looking to kind of chill and be introspective and take a step back. And these guys are jumping into the pool and just joking around in the hot tub, and there's butt cracks and beers and all sorts of things flying around. So who knows exactly what's making people not necessarily feel welcomed. But we'll talk about it when we get to the point where Chad is literally just standing in a corner staring at nothing. So this is not necessarily the best vibe.
Oh, God. And I was ready to, like, take a million shots for Chad, because I was like, oh, they're setting it up. They're setting it up. My last hope is about to die in this episode.
Yeah, well, no, Chad lives on. So we live to play another day as far as Team Wiggler goes, which is good, I think. We need,
yeah.
Listen, you not every team can have Marjorie and Jeremy on it. I mean, it's just not going to work out that way.
I officially have one last chance. That's it. That's all I've got.
Not throwing away your shot, though, are you, Josh?
No.
You're young, scrappy, and hungry.
Yeah, yes. I'm ready. I'm ready for this.
Mike, I would really like you to start a Tumblr wherein every day you just post one of your just beliefs about what the Pacific Northwest is like.
I know, I wasn't going to say anything. It's like everyone in the Pacific Northwest wears Crocs.
Yeah, I feel like I'm going to get like a bunch of hate messages now from Kelly Wentworth, like trashing me completely. So I'm ready. Bring it on. I'm ready to get flamed by a part of the country.
I just want everyone in the Pacific Northwest who listens to this to tweet us the pictures of like your serious Croc collection, because we know you got one.
Of course.
Yeah. Hey, Mike, in Portland, hamburgers eat people.
Yeah. Oh, man. I remind me to never travel west of the Mississippi.
Yeah, horrible things happen, Mike.
You're missing out. Portland's great.
We'd love to hear more of your thoughts in the Pacific Northwest as we go along. Josh, were you pleased to see Antonia back? I know you're a big Antonia fan.
Of course, yeah. I love Antonios and Antonias.
What about the fact that she puked before every quickfire?
That's unsanitary, and it makes me uncomfortable.
It's better than during.
Yeah, have we ever seen any hint of that on the show, Kurt?
Not that I recall. I mean, I've always loved Antonia. I think she was the only person I think that I was actually when I used to watch Cutthroat Kitchen. As you know, she was a regular judge in there, and that was, I think, the main reason. I've just always liked her as a personality. She's kind of got the whole. Just kind of says whatever's on the top of her mind, isn't really like kind of angry at other people necessarily, but just voices her opinion, and you know, pretty funny. So was happy to see her back, but was surprised to definitely to hear that she's comps that she pretty regularly purged before challenges.
Yeah, you gotta purge. Yeah. Gotta purge your tasting hole.
That's so
this is also interesting to see Antonia back, and it wasn't really mentioned on the show, but Antonia has this rep of being, I think they call the Black Hammer. Like, everybody that would participate on team challenges with her would get sent home, and she would be the one staying around. And the quickfire is interesting because the selection of the ingredients is really the key element of this quickfire, and you do sort of have to work as a team. And certain chefs really take different views of how this should operate. It's a 10-ingredient quick fire. Each chef has 20 seconds to pick an ingredient. They know what every other chef has picked before them. So the goal seemingly would be to create ingredient synergy, although there is much debate about this. Mike, if you're in the kitchen and you're first, what ingredient are you picking?
I mean, because when Philip runs out, and we get a lot of like, I feel like we got an inordinate amount of confessionals this episode where someone was throwing shade at another person, and it wasn't completely accurate some of the time. Like Philip, for example, somebody gave a confessional that like, oh, we're hoping for like salt and pepper, and instead he goes for the beef. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad choice. I mean, I wouldn't say it's not salt and pepper. It's not the basics, but at the same time, you need a protein. I think we can judge Isaac's choice a lot more than Phillip's at this point. But I mean, if I were to go first, I probably would go for some sort of protein just because, you know, especially if we show from Team Vegan several weeks ago, we know that it's some people have a really big difficulty in terms of cooking without any sort of protein. So you want to make sure you knock that off right out of the gate.
Kurt, what's the gameplay element here? What's the right call? Is it what Mike's saying?
I agree completely with Mike. I think especially if you, it's going to be kind of the highlight. If you go in that first position, you have the chance to choose the item that's really going to be potentially the featured or highlighted item in a dish that you want to cook. And I think it was a fair assessment by, you know, most of the other, you know, chefs that, well, okay, if, you know, Philip does, you know, picks this protein, then, you know, nobody else is really going to necessarily do that. I think we were surprised to see that Isaac did. But no, completely 100% on board with Philip's choice to get that out of the way.
Josh, if you were really good at preparation of a particular ingredient, like if it was your specialty, right, but it was something obscure or something that you really think that
starfish
you could dominate with. Yeah, are you picking that to throw everyone else off, or are you trying to be a team player here?
No, I think you want to be a team player. I think for me on Top Chef, when you're trying to throw other people under the bus, that can only end badly. It's only going to foster, you know, ill will toward you, even if you get your way and you knock somebody out or whatever you do. If you're playing the sabotage game, I feel like more often than not, you want to stay away from that. So I would probably in this challenge, I would just pick something basic that's going to be useful for everybody and hopefully just bank on the fact that I'm going to be able to bang out some good food.
So Jason shouldn't have picked squid if he had gone first.
No, that would have been a D move, a D bag move.
Well, it is interesting because we talked about how Philip picks first. He takes New York strip. Isaac picks second. He takes another protein and chicken. And then Chad picks third, and Chad picks jalapenos. And Chad mentions kind of in a talking head that he really cooks with jalapeno a lot. He likes spicy food. So it was important for him to get jalapeno kind of on the menu there. And I think that is an interesting pick in light of what we were just talking about, Josh, and in light of what you were saying. The proteins are out of the way, but here Chad is picking what is probably one of his fundamental ingredients and saying it's important for me to have this. Jeremy's next choice is salt, which is sort of the polar opposite of that. Salt is, I'll take this one for the team. We're all going to need salt, so I'll make sure it's up there, no problem. I just think there's some interesting gamesmanship in play here. For example, Marjorie took rice vinegar. Did anybody have a strong opinion about rice vinegar in light of the fact that we had chicken and New York strip and jalapeno and salt so far? Am I missing something there? There wasn't really a good explanation on why she might have taken the rice vinegar.
I mean, I think it ended up, you know, if we're going with results-oriented behavior, a lot of people did end up using some form of vinaigrette, so I guess it helped. But yeah, there is this sort of string where it goes salt, vinegar, olive oil, and garlic. So at the end, you're like, oh, I guess we need vegetables. Like, again, maybe I'm not a chef. I'm reorganizing my mind differently than they are, but you would think that, like, after proteins and, like, a couple of condiments, you would say, okay, let's get some other things in our dish so we don't just have to use a protein and just season it as much as we can with all the various things around us.
Yeah, I mean, and you're right. Like there, we did have this run where Karen picks olive oil. Kwame picks garlic. When he does, he says, I cook with garlic. It's the fundamental kind of flavor in everything that I do. So that's a little more Kwame-centric pick. But then we do get to the point where they're like, we need some vegetables. So Chef Amar takes mushrooms, probably recreationally as well. Carl takes tomatoes, and Jason is left at the end, and this is the kind of head-scratcher Karen specifically weighs in. He takes celery, when I think that some herbs or some other flavor ingredients were probably something more people wanted. This was a big debate at the time, but it seemed like the celery went off pretty well.
Yeah, I was surprised by this. I was surprised that he loaded up Celery Man. I feel like this was the spot where you toss in like some basil or some oregano or something like that. And celery just, yeah, I don't know. But like celery to me just felt like everything else you could see coming together. Like you could make a dish in your head with like basically every single ingredient that was on there. And celery just looked like the outlier. But Antonia was in on it. She's like, this is good.
Yeah, and I think I wondered like to what extent that came down to my, I had the same reaction, Josh, and just like my lack of knowledge about the versatility of celery, like in terms of like the leaves being able to be used.
Because you're a 15-year-old like me. You just think ants on a log.
Yeah, exactly. I thought Jason was going for a high-end ants on a log.
Yeah, you think like, oh, we'll dip this into some blue cheese. We'll turn that chicken into a spicy jalapeno chicken wing.
I would have liked to see like the four of us draft this where like Josh picks celery and then Mike picks peanut butter. I'm like, well, duh, raisins.
Yeah. Everyone just makes ants on a log.
No. The way that you make that a fancy ants on the log is you got to get almond butter instead of peanut butter. And you got
to
get like some other type
of
dry fruit.
You have to get craisins instead of raisins.
Right.
But I think it ended up like Antonia kind of schooled me in terms of like, hey, I guess that was a pretty wise choice. And we even hear Jason later say, I got the sense some people weren't that crazy about my choice of celery, but guess what? Everybody used celery.
Yeah. But can I just say that what a Jason move to pick celery.
Josh, you know, the ancient Romans used celery in a lot of lost recipes.
Like, stop it. It's not even part of his soft on soft edict. Celery's very crunchy.
It's a fundamental underpinning of all Etruscan cuisine since the early 1400s, Josh.
Such a Jason pick, celery.
You know what, though? I think Kurt's right. I think that the fact that Antonia validated it a little bit is interesting because this is such a debate here. I think whoever picks last, unless something like salt is still on the table, whoever picks last, there are going to be people that are like, no, I needed one ingredient to finish this dish I was planning in my mind and you didn't take it. So I think that people are going to be disappointed no matter who picks last, unless it's something super ob. Yeah. But I do think that that's interesting that the celery was such a hot button. And it didn't crush the winning dish. It wasn't like the key part of why the winning dish won. It really wasn't the key part of why the bottom dishes were on the bottom. But I think it was an ingredient that a lot of people use. So that
if Philip went last, he would have like brought out like a table leg. And he's like, great, we're going to use this.
Here's some puffed amaranth. We're fine.
Well, it's interesting is that it's like I thought this was going to be kind of a katsuji a sort of challenge where, oh my gosh, they have to incorporate all these ingredients. But yeah, when they literally break it down, you have like right in a row salt, vinegar, olive oil, garlic kind of picked. Like, oh yeah, you know what, you kind of need all these ingredients. But I still would have liked to have seen like the very last thing been, and Jason went last, he could have picked squid. I would have liked to have seen some sort of out there ingredient, because you look over, except for jalapeno, you look over the list of ingredients and it seems very basic. But then again, I think maybe that's that's the challenge of being a chef, is taking these 10 kind of basic ingredients and doing something unique with them.
Yeah, we do see that uniqueness. And actually, I think one of the interesting things about this quick fire and the way Top Chef sort of does its storytelling and really builds, and they do a very good job of it. It's stuff that comes up in an episode doesn't necessarily impact that episode, but we can file for future reference. And one of these scenes is Marjorie. Marjorie is a little critical of Chef Isaac here, saying that he needs to be more refined in his cooking.
Yeah.
And that's just kind of there. He does end up on the bottom for an underwhelming dish in this quickfire. But I do think that's something to file away. Josh, you have an opinion on that?
No, I when I watched that and when she said that, I was like, oh, that's an interesting note. And I hadn't really thought about it with Isaac before. But if you think about it, it makes sense. Like, he is kind of like this big, brash personality. He's the kind of guy that's going to serve you up a big bowl of gumbo for his 10-year anniversary challenge. And yeah, it's going to be delicious, but it's not like going to be subtle. And as you wear on in a competition like Top Chef, I do think you need to be able to exhibit a certain amount of versatility in order to be really successful. You know, the best Top Chef contestants are that way. And I don't know that I've seen that from Isaac yet. So I thought that was an interesting note. And I definitely filed that away for future reference.
Speaking of that versatility, Mike, do you make anything of the fact that in this basically the same scene, Chef Amar is saying that Jeremy never cooks, that he does a lot of raw prep? His raw dishes have won, so I don't understand this criticism.
It's interesting,
it's just funny.
I feel like the reason why he said it is so that they could keep saying great things about Jeremy, only to do the wah cut to Amar every time it happens.
Forget about that. The wah. Yeah,
I did too. Wah.
I think that this is an example of like these talking head confessionals that are not necessarily correct, which happened a lot this episode between that and, as I said before, them saying like, oh, Philip should have picked salt, or even Karen being like, well, Jason should have picked herbs, and she was the only one that really didn't benefit from him picking the celery, it seems. So yeah, we saw a lot more of Amar in this episode, but this is sort of a mixed bag between his strong showing in this and the elimination challenge, but also him throwing shade at the guy who eventually won. I don't think Jeremy's approaching the Jamie top scallop level of using the same ingredients or the same style every time, but I guess it's something to pay attention to, maybe. I don't know, I didn't see the pattern until he pointed it out.
I just thought it was a really funny scene. You know, it's just, it's funny when he's like saying like, I can't wait until he cooks something. That'll be really fun to watch. I just thought the way that he threw that shade at him was really good. But I think it may not have been a great episode for Amar. That might be a testament to it. You know, even though he is part of the big emotional story later on, we can talk that through later. But I wonder if this was, if you guys think this was a bad episode for him.
Well, I mean, he does end up in the top here at the quickfire. So I think it's a little bit of a mixed episode for him, because there is that, you know, stick your neck out and watch your head get chopped off kind of thing that happens here in the quickfire, where he does lose to Jeremy, and Jeremy's modified carpaccio kind of mostly raw prep.
Right.
So it is interesting. And I think some of the shade between the two of them is good natured competitive shade. I do wonder if anyone has a different read, or a different Josh, as it were, on what is happening with Chef Carl in this quickfire, where he's hoarded all the tomatoes.
Yeah, was it Amar that was throwing shade at Carl, like wondering if it was sabotage, or was it somebody
that was,
else?
That was Jeremy.
Jeremy. Yeah, it's, and I think we even saw it in some of the previews for this week, was like, you know, this one line about the accusation of sabotage, but then it was let go. I don't think it was necessarily intentional.
This was not pea puree 2.0. Yeah.
Exactly. This was not stolen lobster from last week.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead.
I just kind of feel like, does he strike anyone else, or is it just me, and am I just a jerk? I mean, these things might not be mutually exclusive, but I look at Carl and he looks like one of those guys who's like out in like the first three episodes of Top Chef and you completely can't even remember that person's name, and yet he's somehow still around here in the top eight.
Well, you make a good point, because we had a tweet from MarchCrazy44 who asked what we thought of Carl in the episode. Because in March Crazy 44's opinion, Carl seemed to be getting more exposure as the season goes on. Is Carl a potential winner?
Right.
And you're seeming to be out on Carl.
That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, on almost any other season, you put like Carl Dooley on there, and he is one of like the first four people gone in like a double elimination episode, and you just don't even remember that person's name. And yet he's still here. And the fact that he's still here, and the fact that he's gaining some visibility, means like he's breaking an archetype for me.
Yeah, he's under-edited a little bit. I mean, but you could say that about, you know, Chad before last episode, or even Amar before the past couple of episodes as well. There's been this sort of weird editing this season where we've gotten a lot of great stories from everyone, and maybe it's because the increase in personal challenges that's allowed for that, but it's been a lot of things. Like, I think we've seen a good amount of Philip every episode, we've seen a good amount of Kwame every episode. Back when we had, you know, Giselle, Grayson, and Angelina on, they were getting a lot of exposure as well. So maybe because, as you talked about last week, Josh, those big characters all seem to go out in the first six episodes, they kind of had to make room by sort of putting everyone else under the table for now, and now they're finally able to peek over it with everyone else gone.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and see, I guess I have the opposite reaction, that for me, Carl was like one of the standouts that stuck out of my mind in the first episode. I think he was my first round draft pick. He struck me as just being just very enthusiastic about the show, not like very excited to be there. You're a huge fan of the show. I do agree that like you do kind of see a shift in the in how much screen time or attention he's gotten, especially if you compare Carl and Chad. There has been kind of a flip there, but he hasn't really faded as the background that much for me. But I also don't know how much of that's the fact that he's on my team, so I'm a little bit more attuned to him and to Karen.
Yeah, I mean, he had the carrot soup in the first episode, and it was spiced really amazingly, the Mediterranean influence that he drew. And that seems to be the kind of focus of his cooking. He's Boston-based, so he's a little bit out of his wheelhouse here. But, you know, I think he did get featured a little bit more in the first couple of episodes of the season. And then he's gone into kind of a lull here, where he hasn't been doing as Mike is saying, telling their personal stories. Maybe he is a little under edited, and that's why maybe Josh, for you, he just feels like he's breaking an archetype, because we're not really getting Carl the person that much. And so we don't really know. He just seems like a guy who isn't getting a lot of screen time because he goes home early, and he's definitely not gone home early. So it is kind of fascinating to read into the edit a little bit that way. I mean, we do that in all reality shows, but in this show in particular, there are opportunities, even when it's not someone's boot episode, to show them talking to their spouse, to show them talking about their daughter, to show them talking about their time in the Navy or why they became a chef or whatever. We just really haven't got a ton of that from Carl as we're going along. So theoretically, if Carl stays in this competition, more of that story should come to the surface. But it just really hasn't popped. I mean, we'll talk more about what his 10 years ago story looks like. But it was the most bland and boring, I think, of the stories, or among them. It was just like, this is a restaurant. This is a restaurant I cooked at. Here's a dish that they cooked. And even though he does really well with it, it just isn't, it's not thrilling. So he seems like a funny guy. He had a great one-liner earlier this season about in Korea, they just call Korean food Korean, or they just call it food. And it, you know, made the guest chef laugh pretty hard, and that's the way it was. But he just doesn't seem to really be popping. So it is interesting. The people that are popping ended up on the bottom here. Karen, no focus in her dish. Isaac, his meal was underwhelming. He could be the confessional king, but he doesn't seem to be making it to the top very much in the show. So maybe he's getting over-edited. The top dishes in the quickfire were Jeremy with his modified carpaccio and Amr, his great technique in the dish that he prepared. And ultimately, Jeremy does win the quickfire. That seemed like that jived with what the editing was presenting. Is everybody on point with that?
Yeah.
Yep. This was a little pop from Jeremy, too, because we didn't, you know, for being such a front runner in the first couple of episodes, I feel like we didn't really see him in these middle episodes. Now, he had a really, I mean, he's going to do really well here and not do really well in the next, like, we'll talk about that in, like, probably 15 minutes from now. But this was, like, a nice little resurgence of Jeremy as a character, I feel like.
Yeah. Jeremy, it's a good thing you have immunity.
Replete with reference to his MySpace page.
Oh my god! Can we talk about that hair metal band?
The hair
metal.
Oh my
god, Mike. What I want to know from you first, Mike. What was your MySpace page like?
So I had a when I was younger. I sometimes get comparisons to Zach Braff in terms of looks. I believe around that time the movie Garden State had come out, which was his like big feature film and his big debut outside of Scrubs. So my picture was an homage to him, where I had balls written on my forehead, and that was my MySpace profile picture. And I did not get any dates from it. Surprise, surprise!
Isn't that unfortunate?
I know,
Josh. That was so snarky. What was on your MySpace page, buddy?
I'm actually like doing a Google search right now, and I can't find anything because did I not have a MySpace?
That's
I don't
impossible.
Know. I think I had like a MySpace that I didn't really use very much.
Kurt, how did you use MySpace?
I constantly just fretted over like who was going to be in my top 8 and my top 16 in terms of like the placement on the front page. I didn't want to leave anybody out.
Oh, that's very nice. You're such a nice person. Yeah.
Although a couple of years ago, I noticed that there was a MySpace app, and I actually downloaded the MySpace app to my iPhone. So, and I got maybe about a week's use of it before I deleted it.
And you probably got a lot of malware, too.
What do you mean?
It looks like when I Google Josh Wiggler MySpace.
Yeah, I just found something, actually.
Some Valentines are coming up.
Oh, are they Christian Bale Valentines?
They appear to be Superman related or Batman.
Those are Valentines.
Valentine's, okay.
Valentine's Day is a great tradition. This is completely off track, but Valentine's Day is a great tradition that my former coworkers at Wizard Magazine and I came up with back around the time of The Dark Knight, where we just took quotes from The Dark Knight and pictures of actors from The Dark Knight, mostly Christian Bale, and turned them into like Valentine's Day cards, and we called them Valentine's Day cards.
Nice. What did your search locate besides
that? I have a myspace.com/roundhoward. That features artwork from an old comic book that I was going to be doing, but it never happened, and it's sad.
Is there a song that plays when you?
No, it's very sparse. Except there's like three photos of
one of the characters I was going to be.
Wow, so artsy with your little headphones and tangle of wire as a background picture.
Yeah.
Wow, so you're on there right now, Mike.
Oh, yeah. Once you gave the exact link, and I'm sure the people that are listening did this too as soon as you gave out the link.
Yeah, I mean, is there anything on here other than, like, my background, what I'm looking at right now is like a drum set. I'm hitting reload and now it's a beach.
One of your connections is a guy who's smoking a cigarette with Barack Obama.
Oh, Nick Fury. He's a good...
Yeah. You're also friends with Arizona.
Mm-hmm, that was
the entire state.
Yes,
that was my brother's band. I'm loving how we're doing like a live dive back to 10 years ago today, or it's probably. I'd like to know.
So hand in hand with this, Josh, if you had to create a dish based on all of these experiences, Arizona, Nick Fury, smoking with Barack Obama. What would your dish be? What are we dishing up, Josh Wiggler, 10 years ago?
I don't know.
What kind of pizza would it be?
My friend Harrison has, he's one of my connections on there as well, and he has a picture of a drink that says water salad. So maybe it'd be some kind of water salad with Arizona iced tea.
I don't think you would win. Mike, do you have a MySpace? Do you have a dish from 10 years ago? It doesn't have to be inspired by your MySpace. Please, in fact, after we saw what happened with Jason earlier, let's not cook up a Mike-inspired balls dish. Do you have any dishes from 10 years ago?
I guess 10 years ago, and this is going to probably make a lot of people feel sad. 10 years ago was my second half of junior year of high school, which makes me sound extremely young. But I remember it was probably the first time I ever had laryngitis in my life.
That's delicious.
And it was, and I felt horrible because there were auditions for the school musical and I like could not speak, but I was still able to do it, nail it and get the part. Through my reputation alone, which was nice. And then I biffed the part after getting it, which was not so nice. So if I had to come up with a dish, it would probably be, I don't know, some sort of like tea-inspired plate, because I drank a lot of tea during that time period.
That makes you throw up afterwards, just that, you know, it's like that...
It's going to be tea bagged with hints of Ipecac in it.
Well, and that goes with your MySpace picture. Kurt, what about you?
10 years ago, I had just moved to Los Angeles, and it was about that. I'd been there for maybe 8 months or so, but I think it was about this time that I just discovered my favorite karaoke place in L.A., and they have the most amazing macaroni and cheese there. So I'd probably have to do some sort of macaroni and cheese dish of some sort.
Nice. Yeah, that would be pretty good. I was wondering if Blue Apron existed in 2006, but I was thinking back, it probably didn't.
No, and I just found my MySpace page, and I'm like, who are these people?
Your top eight? You don't even know who they are?
They don't even have the top eight anymore. I'm like, that. Why should I even go back now?
Yeah, that's true. And sometimes looking back on past relationships can be a real downer. Just ask Kwame, right?
Awkward.
Well, before we go into all of that, Antonio, why aren't you talking about your MySpace experiences?
Nobody asked me. That's
well,
why.
I just did.
That's why. I'm trying to remember what I did on MySpace. I'm sure I tried to create a profile that made me look more impressive than I was. That's my kind of go-to from 10 to 15 years ago, for sure. I was probably upset that I couldn't get on Facebook because I wasn't in school, but Facebook was around then in 2006. And I'm sure I was jealous of that. I'm trying to remember what I did with my top eight. I think, Kurt, rather than have to fret like you and go the route where I was worried about offending anyone, I didn't put anybody I knew in my top eight. I think I had like celebrities or bands or stuff like that in my top eight so that I wouldn't offend anyone. I'm trying to think of any other unfortunate. I'm trying to think. I know with AOL at one point, I had an alias on AOL that implied that I was an art thief, and I did once get what I considered to be a legitimate query about stealing art on AOL. This was before the real heavy days of catfishing. That never really happened to me on MySpace. I think I kept a low pro. I will say I had a picture of myself with dreadlocks. I actually look like Coolio, and that was it was a costume party I went to. I had braided my hair up with pipe cleaners and all sorts of crazy stuff. And I'm remembering now the January 2006 period. It's right before I went to law school. And I was requesting people on MySpace that had listed that they were going to Cincinnati Law as to add for friends. And a lot of people that I subsequently became friends with were like, I did not grant your request because you look like a creep in your MySpace picture.
So yours would probably be some sort of then Jamaican inspired dish.
Yeah, I don't even know what, like something, you know, like a fantastic voyage through a gangster's paradise of food.
Or it's catfish dish.
Yes, is what my meal would be. Yeah. So yeah, or catfish from, you know, what people thought I was trying to do to them. So one or the other, really. That was MySpace. I don't know. I don't know how to find my MySpace page. I think I years ago tried to log back in and was not allowed for one reason or another. I don't know what happened there, but I'd love to go. I'm trying to remember if I would have had any music playing, you know, like MySpace let you set up so that you could autoplay music or have themes. Of course, that's what drove MySpace into the ground, but we're getting really off topic.
Yeah.
We're like this so far off
topic. I had a really good time.
I turned around to look for topic behind me, and it's nowhere to be found. Like, we're well past it. So
let's go back to the uplifting topic of Kwame and his father's deteriorating relationship from a decade ago.
Speaking of, it is interesting. It's sad. And I had wondered when they said 10 years ago what Kwame would bring to the table, because he mentioned, I think, some number less than 10 years ago, he was selling candy on the train trying to start a catering business. And so I know that I don't think he's been a chef for 10 years. And so I wonder what his inspiration would be. Unfortunately, what's very negative inspiration, sounds like he has a very bad relationship with his father, and that caused him to use jerk seasoning on broccoli.
I love that it's like, you jerk.
That's how I interpreted it.
Yeah. I wish you were to describe, like, I decided to use jerk seasoning because my father was a jerk.
And limp
broccoli because he was not well endowed.
Yeah.
Full bloom.
Yep. Yeah, at least three-quarter bloom, for sure. Yeah. But yeah, I don't know why, what was in Kwame's head, but it was bad. And this is tough because Kwame has been such a standout performer on this season. He's been a guy who's wise beyond his years. He's offered counsel and support to other chefs. He's been diplomatic. He's been so many good things that you only sometimes learn through conflict. And it's not surprising that he's had conflict in his life. When you look back at the person he is, wise beyond his years, it seems obvious that you know, he's probably struggled and suffered through something now, looking back on it. At the time, you don't think, well, that guy, he's so smart, he's so everything, he must have had some adversity. But now thinking about it, it makes sense that he would be wise beyond his years, because he's been through some stuff with his dad specifically, and has had a rough go of it, and probably was forced to grow up a lot sooner in terms of confronting a lot of emotional issues with that than a lot of other people were. And I think that probably manifests in the person he is today in a very positive way in a lot of what he does. But we saw it come out, I think he admitted at least that it came out in a negative way in this challenge. It got in his head, focusing on that kind of thing got in his head, and it made a really rough dish for Kwame. He ended up on the bottom, which is really tough, and it's very unusual to see him there.
Yeah, it wasn't clear cut for me that necessarily Jason was going to go. And looking at the bottom three, I'm sure we'll get to it. I was like, any of these three people go, it's going to affect the dynamics in the show.
It's going to affect my team. Yeah.
Well, no, actually, quite the opposite. If any of these three people go, it's not going to affect my team, but, or it's going to affect yours. I was worried for him. He was like definitely out of the three, the one that I wanted to make sure stuck around.
It was pretty clear that I wanted Jason to go. I felt pretty good about that. Because you want Kwame around. Kwame's really great, and he's, you know, he had a bad week. What are you going to do? And you just need Philip to hang in there. Hang in there a little tiny bit longer, Philip.
Yep, I completely agree. Even though I picked Philip after Jason in the draft, and it was only because it was between him and Grayson, Jason was sort of the least of three evils in this case. We're like, I completely agree, Josh. Kwame is... might be my favorite contestant besides Isaac left in this competition, just because of his competence and like you said, Josh, he's a really interesting person in general. And Philip is just bringing so many laughs, whether he's intended or unintended. And so Jason just sort of stuck out like a sore thumb wearing Crocs.
like one does in the Northwest.
Like you do in the Northwest.
Yeah.
Pacific Northwest attire. Yeah.
Yes. This is classic Portland, classic Seattle. This is just that's haute culture, in those
you
areas.
Love those Seattle Crocs.
They're great in the rain, Josh. They're indeed. So good
indeed.
Yeah, and maybe get some green Crocs. Marjorie would like to wear them because she cooks a green dish because she was green 10 years ago. Are you guys okay with the playing with the metaphor there?
Yeah, that's fine. That's great, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that was great.
I mean, she won, and it seemed like it was a tasty dish, and it seemed like a yummy dish, as you might say. I think that, you know, obviously it was very good, and I think it played with the story that she was trying to tell. Like, I was new back then, look how far I've come, and everyone really responded to it.
And what a Mike Isabella heavy episode between her name dropping him, and we also see his cousin take place in both of these competitions.
Yeah, cousin. Antonia.
Yeah, it's if I didn't have issue with Giselle's blind date story, which she based her dish on, I'm not going to have an issue with Marjorie's green story.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I did have issue with Giselle's story, and I took a little issue with this from Marjorie, only in comparison to some of the other chefs who I felt had much more personal stories. Hers was sort of wordplay based, and it wasn't even a dish that she had learned 10 years ago when she was green. It didn't have anything to do with the restaurant or time period or anything. It was more like, I'm cooking a green dish because I was green then. And then she also said, curry's kind of chaotic to prepare, but it all comes together in the end. And that's kind of how I feel about my time as a chef. It's a good story. As a BS artist myself, I know when we smell our own. Let's just put it that way.
What does it smell like?
Yeah, it smells like green curry. It
smells like pipe cleaner dreadlocks.
Tasty.
So, Mike, I don't like your fishing for a hashtag there, buddy. But yeah, I do feel like that was a little bit of a cop out. Karen was, you know, oh, I was so poor. So, and when I was poor, we just boiled a lot of water instead of heat, and we made pasta because we were boiling water. So I'm going to make pasta. And some of these other stories were pretty good. Anybody have any standout stories they wanted to feature? Were there any that jumped out that people, you know, were really pleased with?
Well, I will say that even though you said Karen's story was a little unremarkable, we did have a lingering question answered here where we actually didn't remember if she was gay or not. She is. She said, you know, she lived with her girlfriend. So we have at least that answer substantiated.
Yeah, I thought about that. And part of the reason I was confused, I think, is because she refers to her spouse as her spouse, whereas when her spouse was on the phone, she referred to Karen as her wife. And I think that Karen's not calling her wife, is, I think, the part that confused me. And people are free to use whatever nomenclature or terminology they want, but I think that's where I got hung up. But yeah, here we have Karen saying she lived with her girlfriend. She was making pasta for them. I did think it was funny. They were impersonating Tom and Padma here, and everyone's getting hammered. And this is where we get Carl's story, not from 10 years ago, but from a year and a half ago. We go back to Carl's
story.
Sad story. Not Carl. Chad's story. My apologies. Yes. And we
come
go back
get my
to
man right. Get Angelina's story.
Yes. Yeah. Angelique's story, Mike. Come on. Get it right. So we go back and we really do see what was up with Chad. This is, as we discussed last week in this podcast, not a Chad just decides he doesn't want to drink anymore kind of thing. This is a Chad, for health reasons, quit drinking and lost a ton of weight. Is not happy about this kind of party that Jeremy seems to be at the center of. Jeremy, mind you, when he won immunity, said, I'm going to get hammered tonight, basically. So I think we're seeing a little bit of that while other chefs are focusing on the prep of their meal. Josh, how did this make you feel seeing your team member here? You're so
singular.
Yeah.
Charlie Browning it here. This was really sad.
My entire team, Chad Browning it. I was worried. I was like, oh, well, you put this in here either because he's going to excel tonight or he's going home. And like, it was the same thing with last week. We're like, oh, you're putting him in the spotlight to talk about his San Diego know-how because either he's going to, you know, he's going to slam dunk or he's going to fizzle out. And I was really worried. I'm just like constantly on the edge of my seat with this guy because he's my only hope. So I was worried. I was really nervous. Obviously, it works out so I can look at it objectively now. And it's an emotional story. You know, that's tough. You know, certainly I know people who've suffered from alcoholism, addiction. I know people who have partied too hard and have chosen, like, I just need to walk away from it, whether or not it's an addiction. So it's a very human, relatable story that he's telling here, and good for him that he's got his head on straight. But I hope that he isn't getting too hung up on, you know, kind of the atmosphere of his fellow chef testants and where he's fitting in with that. And I hope that's not getting too far into his head. But overall, I mean, it was a big moment for my man, Chad.
Yeah, and it was a big moment. He ended up at the top. He made a great ceviche. This is fantastic for him because I think that's a much better story than and having it work out negatively like you were saying. So very glad that that did work out for him. Carl, we talked about this already. Carl is cooking a ragu in a French snail dish inspired by a restaurant he was working at 10 years ago. Similarly, Jason is making a dish from a restaurant he was working in 10 years ago. Jason notes how difficult that dish is and how much of a dick he was to people making it. So he's not really starting from a positive place. Isaac also really isn't starting from the most positive place. He talks about being displaced by Hurricane Katrina 10 years ago. But then he does tell, I think, a pretty good story about how he had to kind of hang out with his family in Cajun country. And he had to feed 30 Cajuns at once. So he's going to make a gumbo kind of infused with a whole bunch of different Cajun influences and recipes on the sides and surrounding it, knowing, I think, that this is something that's right in his comfort zone and that he can do really well with. And so that's good. Chad tells us about his military service again and talks about, I think, really just kind of getting out of the military, relaxing with his grandfather, and learning about the pureness of ceviche. We actually also had another story about ceviche. Mike, why don't you tell us, this is what I would like you to do, Mike. I would like you to tell us about Philip's dish as Philip.
All right. Yeah, so I was dating this Peruvian chick, and I probably slept over because, you know, banging uglies, and I met her grandmother, and she said, "Oh, I'm gonna cook you this succulent ceviche." So that's how I learned how to make it. So I'm gonna throw a bunch of seafood on a pan and see what happens.
Oh, God,
Josh, listen, don't hold it against anyone. That was Philip talking, not Mike.
Damn you, Philip. Wow. Bang, yeah, uglies.
That's strangely that's accurate. That was pretty much awful.
That's really good.
This is Mike, this is you getting out of your system prior to the Once Upon a Time return, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, just checking.
No, I was gonna do my Philip character for the entirety of my podcasting career now. I feel like I've really tapped into a good oil well there.
Well, the next step, it's obviously whining about the judges to the judges. Can you do that?
Yeah. Well, I actually don't believe that my dish was bad. I think that's just your opinion. And, you know, the judges, you know, I initially want to cook my food, but I guess I'll cook what the judges want because, you know, it's their show, I guess.
Josh, was this a good plan for Philip to tee off on the judges to the judges?
No.
Like, you can see Tom's face is like, did I just hear that correctly? Like, he didn't know how to react to what Philip had just said.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Michael Voltaggio didn't take it too well either. I would not ever say anything like that to Michael Voltaggio.
And I like, they do eventually reply. They say, well, no, just cook good food.
Yeah, stop whining. How about that?
Is the Peruvian girlfriend the hipster version of the Canadian girlfriend that you've never met?
she lives in Peru, yeah.
Yeah, Peru.
Yeah. She's
never met her.
We don't need to follow that down the road too far, but yeah, that's good. I like
to a different camp in the summer.
Exactly.
No, but this is Philip. If you missed it last week, it's in the link from the show that's posted at robhasawebsite.com. Philip wrote and directed a movie about his life, wherein he seems to come off as quite the Lothario in this film. Mike, I know you've been really just focused on that the last
week. Yeah, I mean, we've sort of made some parallels between him and Coach Wade from Survivor. This is his 180. This is like his masterpiece, his ode, his life story in a movie. And we've just watched the teaser, but you can tell he's taking the biopic route in terms of overblowing certain aspects of his own life. And definitely, I think his womanizing is part of that.
When I locked my girlfriend in the restaurant for dinner, there were four locks on the door, not three.
Well, he gives a specific line of like, he gives us like really, you know, cheesy voiceover, like, we have to make a choice, like, you know, yes or no, blonde or brunette. And it's like, yeah, this is horrible, but I need to see this movie.
I don't know if take that one for the team, but then report back and like, Is it so bad it's bad, or is it so bad it's good?
I will gladly take that bullet. I'll see if I can, and if listeners can find some sort of link on the Top Chef Reddit as well, send it to me, and I will gladly sit down and watch this masterpiece of cinema.
Unfortunately, I'm not confident that the film was ever made. That appeared to be a teaser. for the Kickstarter for the film, which I don't know if the Kickstarter was successfully funded. Having seen that teaser, I don't see how it wasn't, but I don't see evidence of the actual film being out there, so who knows. But Philip is in his own world, and that's good. The thing about Philip is I really think that he's not really motivated negative. He's not trying to sabotage anyone. We talked a little bit about this last week, but I've been thinking about it. The same things that Jason was calling Philip out for in terms of shrinking back a little bit and in defense of his dish, Jason was guilty of saying, oh, soft on soft, it just eats well. You know, you just got to eat it a little more. Like, that was my intention. It'll be fine. And then, you know, that's obviously not true. Like, the dish was a mess. But he was really trying to mealy-mouth his way through defending it. And that's exactly what he is upset about with Philip. And so I want to be very careful not to pile too much on Philip here, because he's getting an edit. That's certainly true of reality TV. Anyone who's on reality TV is getting an edit. But they're certainly cherry-picking certain things for Philip out and telling the story here. It'll be interesting to see, I think, what the arc for this story is, if there is any redemption for him, if we are building towards a restaurant wars flame out, like we're all kind of thinking might be the case. But
hoping.
There's a story being told, or hoping in your case, Josh. There's definitely a story being told here. Where it ends, nobody knows. Speaking of stories, I thought Chef Amar had a much better story on the flip side of what Chef Marjorie's story was about being green. Chef Amar talks about a very specific dish that one of his mentors cooked, a lobster dish. Yeah. And unfortunately, that mentor, Chef Jerry Hayden, has since passed away. We saw the title card at the end of the episode, right, in memoriam. But at this point, was very sick with ALS. And tells a very touching story and gets a thumbs up from the judges and does, I think, cook a good dish. So that I think that was more the kind of story we often see on Top Chef, not the kind of wordplay thing Marjorie was bringing to the table.
Yeah, I think I liked this. I thought the story was really great. The dish was obviously successful to a certain extent. But I thought that it was not a great sign that, you know, Amar is cooking this dish with this really powerful emotional story that pushes Tom Colicchio to tears, and isn't even in the conversation for winning the competition at the end of the thing. And that just says to me, like, if Amar can't, you know, if he can't be in the mix with that challenge, it makes me question his prospects moving forward. So that's why I was saying earlier I didn't think it was a fantastic episode for Mar, even though his story was great and it seems like he had a mostly successful dish.
Yeah, you think that if the dish you choose to create is basically a tribute dish, that's a tribute dish for a chef that the judges know, you think that would maybe gives you a few bonus points in terms of the that could even potentially make up for execution, but apparently it did not.
Yeah, and he wasn't on the bottom, right, but he certainly wasn't on the top.
It was probably high middle, but, you know, just the fact that he was even there, you know, just speaks to me that, I don't know, that doesn't seem like a great sign to me.
I think it's a fair point, and I think that we've seen him at the top with other dishes that don't have that kind of story. It also shows, I think, the sort of interesting debate that comes up with Top Chef from time to time about some of these competitions, and we've seen it play out in this season. Do you go with who was more creative and who made maybe a more inspiring dish? Do you go with the person who went with the spirit of the challenge more? How do you determine exactly where to go with this? And this is a question that chefs struggle with throughout. Most famously, I think, when Chef CJ gets a pickle challenge and cooks a burger, thinking that Tom Colicchio is going to say, you know what's really good with the pickle? It's just a good burger. You need a good burger. And so they cook a burger, and Colicchio just immediately rejects it out of hand as, like, too simple, not featuring the pickle enough, a really bad idea. And this is just them trying to game the challenge instead of being inspired by the circumstances to create really good food, which is what seems like Chef Marjorie was. So maybe the story really isn't all that important for the competition, even though it is pretty important for the show.
I still think Marjorie's story was pretty good.
Well, listen, it's better than Kwame's story, which is sad. He does talk about how he hasn't really spoken to his dad in 8 years. He makes the broccoli with the jerk seasoning, and that does end up on the bottom. The top of the competition were Marjorie, Chad, and Carl. We didn't mention really Carl does make it to the top of this competition with his classic timeless French cooking, and Marjorie does win with this green curry. But the bottom were Kwame, Philip, and the comments for Philip were basically like, everything is wrong with your dish. Underwhelming, not enough acid. I just don't think Tom really likes Philip. And then Jason was at the bottom for just being completely underseasoned and a lack of focus. Were you guys surprised based on the bottom three and the way that it was presented? Josh, you already kind of talked about how you thought it might be that this might be it for Kwame. Did you feel like the edit really tipped it off one way or the other?
No, not necessarily. I mean, it did seem like it could have been Kwame because, you know, they were really emphasizing him. He's like cutting himself as he's cooking. Like, it's just a horrible day for this guy. So you could really see it going for him. Philip, you know, he was so exasperated, and the trash that he was throwing back at the judges was like, this, you know what? This guy is on borrowed time, and it might just be that time is up. And then Jason, once they start laying into him with like, what's going on with you, Jason? You seem joyless these days. Like, there were arguments for all three of them. I think that it was really up in the air. I mean, frankly, I am kind of surprised that it wasn't Kwame or Philip. Those two seem to have more egregious offenses. And I think maybe in choosing to get rid of Jason, I know that they try to do it on a case-by-case basis. But I do feel like it was just kind of like, well, all three of your dishes sucked. And Jason, you've just given us the least, so you're out.
They're probably still tasting the squid meatballs from last week. So technically, it impacted this round.
Some unwanted seasoning is still left over.
Yeah, and that was the part that struck me, is that they were asking him, you know, what's wrong with you? Jason's saying, I need more confidence. Tom saying emotion matters. And I thought this was all being built to kind of continue the narrative of Jason, that these comments were in there because Jason was going to stick around next week and we were going to hear him talk about how I really got to get my groove back, got to get my mojo back. I need some confidence. I thought this was but this is what he's saying to the person who gets eliminated. So I thought that there was some kind of TV editing trick going on there. I thought that it really wasn't that at all. It was pretty straightforward, just presenting that Jason is maybe a good chef who was in a funk and really wasn't feeling the competition.
Well, I'm wondering if there's a chance for that to continue. I mean, you know, once we just talk about Last Chance Kitchen, I mean, is that where his, you know, his second chance or his redemption story comes through in terms of he does get that chance to find that joy again? I mean, without, you know, flashing too far ahead, he does seem a lot more upbeat in Last Chance Kitchen than he does on the actual show. But I actually thought that, you know, what's wrong? I didn't know if it was going to be him complaining about the bro down that's going on in the show where he doesn't seem to fit in. I thought that maybe that was what was going to come up when Tom started questioning him, because that's really the main way he's talked about how discontent he's been is in relation to the relationships he's had with the other chefs.
Yeah, I think that's a good observation. There's certainly a deeper, much longer story and for a different show for sure about what's been going on or what was going on with Chef Jason before this was shot and then during the shooting, because he had left his exec positions 2 months before this all kind of came to be. He didn't seem to be happy. He mentions being creatively frustrated and stymied and trying to pick some of that stuff back up on Top Chef. But he just seemed like a much better chef than he displayed on the show. I think he might be the first person to tell you that. His headspace wasn't right for what this show is and requires, and he didn't put his best food forward. Great. So he does get eliminated. Kwame and Philip live to play another day, hopefully to Restaurant Wars for both of them. Although I'm looking at this cast, I was thinking about this before we did this podcast. Who's the next likely boot? It's got to be Philip, right? Josh, you were pushing back at this hardcore, but who's the chef who's next? I mean, I don't see the kind of obvious boot in among these people next episode, unless it's Philip.
Was I pushing against it hardcore? I think all I was pushing against is, like, if you ask Philip, like, Philip, look around the room, who is next? That Philip wouldn't say me.
Yeah,
though Philip. It probably is Philip. You know, odds on favor to go home next, because he's just not working out, but there's others in the mix as well. You could see a lot of people going. I think that's one of the things that's been great about this season, is that
It's up and down.
I'm in particular, I'm starting to see a little bit of a downward slope for Karen. I know you said that she was riding high at the end of last episode, but I mean, she finished in the bottom in the quick fire. Elimination Challenge, she didn't finish at the bottom, but she still didn't do great. She did the pasta with the pork ragu and the broccoli rabe, and the judge that looks like Frau from Austin Powers said that she needed a marriage counselor to help with marry her noodle and her sauce, and nobody really seemed to be great on it. So I think that Karen kind of had a cool episode here, which does not bode extremely well. But I agree with Josh. I could see, like, you know, I could definitely see Philip squeak by for another episode, because he has for a good amount of episodes previously. And I could see, you know, Karen, maybe even someone like Chad or Amar go home next episode.
Isaac could go too.
Or I mean, this is really, I think that now we're really into a stage where, like, even like with the exception of Philip, everyone is really good and has had really bright spots in the competition. And I feel like they're getting to the stage of the game where if you just happen to cook a bad dish on one day, you're going to go home because of it, even if you're a front runner.
Yeah. So is this, how many, did we start with 17 chefs? Is that right?
Yeah.
It's an odd number. So this isn't quite the midway point, where we don't really have a midway point. So we're with 9 chefs remaining. We're right at what is close to the midway point of a 17 chef season. Halfway through next episode will be the midway point. So do we have a clear winner in sight then, since we don't have a clear next boot? Is there a clear winner that we're looking at here?
Right now, for me, the most the most winning chef, I think that Jeremy's pointed in the right direction. I would say that Jeremy is the least likely to be gone in the next 2 to 3 episodes. So I think you know, Marjorie, I think, is up there as well. So I say for me, those two are kind of the shining stars. But on Top Chef, you can like crash in an instant. So go ahead.
I was just saying, well, even Jeremy did not have a great stellar half of the latter episode either. I mean, he has this sort of almost like movie-esque story of he traveled across the country with his mom to find her birth mother, and he decides to do this weird plating combination of lobster ravioli with salmon, and like he happened to be with Kwame, and Tom basically railed them both, or being like, you two are the big front runners and you put out really bad dishes. So I think that Jeremy got really lucky that he won immunity, because I could definitely have seen them on the bottom if he wasn't safe for that round.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I think, the point we've been making throughout this competition, which is that it is sort of wide open. There are a lot of really talented chefs. Clearly, Kwame and Jeremy, as Tom points out, have been near the top a lot of the time. Marjorie is also claiming some scalps here. And, you know, Karen did win last week. So it does seem to be sort of an open show here. And it's not 100% clear where we're going. But you're right, Mike. The needle isn't necessarily pointing well for Jeremy. Although maybe he did just get hammered the night before and didn't really focus on his dish. Any other observations from the episode before we move on to Last Chance Kitchen?
I feel like we'd be remiss not to talk about, I mean, we did see, it's weird that they didn't outright mention that May was there. We cut to her like a couple of shots.
I hated that.
Because she's the winner of last season. Maybe we have a closer attachment to her because we did podcasts about that season. But I was a little too sad to see that. Also, I feel like Shireen, Oskuya hasn't seen the episode yet, or she would be fangirling right now on Twitter about Michael Voltaggio being on her screen again.
Yeah, maybe.
He looks like he's lost some weight. He looks very gaunt, Michael.
In a good or bad way, Kurt?
In a bad way, for me, so, I thought. So,
yeah, well, maybe.
Eat something, Michael.
Eat something.
It's hard to eat while you're working, creating food all day. Then when were you going to eat? So anyway, yeah, it is. I thought it was kind of a bonehead move, not to mention May. And I thought maybe I missed it.
It did feel a little like, part of me was wondering if the like logistics for the real challenge got canceled, because I liked the simplicity of cook in the kitchen, cook something with like, there's no ingredient limitations or any special twist. They're going to be serving and plating, like doing everything in the kitchen. It seemed like a very simple, kind of very throwback challenge, which I really liked. But a part of me was also just wondering, just because it was so basic in terms of its structure, if something had gone wrong with the logistics for the real challenge.
Well, it was interesting to me because they talked about how it was a 10-year anniversary of Top Chef. And of course, Pat was not the host for the first season. And it was not exactly the same show. And this being in California, this season is sort of an homage to that 10-year. But the challenge wasn't about, like, here's the first elimination challenge we ever did 10 years ago.
A second chances challenge, sort of?
Yeah, no, it wasn't anything like that. It was, you know, here's a dish. We want you to cook a dish inspired by where you were 10 years ago. But I did think the simplicity of the challenge was more in line with Top Chef Season 1. There was some crazy stuff on Top Chef Season 1, no doubt. But there were also simple challenges like this. And I thought that maybe that was where that was coming from. Though I agree with you, Kurt, it's entirely possible with how sort of strung together it was that this was kind of an audible off of some greater plan that might have been in place that didn't work out. I don't know.
It's probably fan fiction, but you know, it's something that just stuck in my head as I was watching it.
Which Top Chef past challenge did you guys like more? This one or the one from season 10 where they each got like a moment from the past 9 seasons and had to make a dish based on that moment?
I always like those personally. I think that that's a good way to reference the show's history without, and they do a good job of showing clips without really doing kind of an all-star season every, you know, or having as many. I mean, they've fallen into those traps a little bit, but I like that. I like that they've had in the past cook recipes off of a certain page in the Top Chef cookbook. So they've kind of featured almost homages to previous seasons, and I think in creative ways that don't require them to have returning players every season.
And you don't, and it keeps you honest too. I mean, you could have easily made up a memory to validate a dish that you wanted to cook. And it's that sort of challenge that you described, Mike, from season 10, or like, you know, picking a rant. Like, there's guidelines that they can judge it against versus simply having to cook something. And
like a green curry, you mean?
Exactly.
No comment. So yeah, anything else from the episode before we get into Last Chance Kitchen?
Nope.
All right. So let's talk about the Last Chance Kitchen. Jason thought Garrett would be who he was cooking against. Is this Jason's opinion of Garrett is just north of mine. That's about the only person I know that likes Garrett more. Are you guys surprised by this at all?
I mean, you also have to think about, like, now that we know more about Jason as the food historian, you would see that him and Garrett would get along like peas and carrots, because they both probably have a mighty high opinion of the history of cooking and their knowledge of it as applied to their own cooking.
That's true. That is true. Garrett, his parents were academics. I'm not sure if you guys know this. I know everything about Garrett that was mentioned on the show, and many things that weren't. Garrett, had this very kind of uppity idea about, I forget what the exact term he used was, but he saw food as sort of this philosophical thing that was happening. And of course, he went home for cooking an incredibly complicated dish at the first kind of service where they had to press it out for 200 people. So not surprising there. It was just surprising to me that Jason's like, yeah, maybe it'll be Garrett. It's like, dude, that was like 6 weeks ago. Come on, man. But it is not Garrett. It's Angelina, as we saw last week.
He's like, great.
Yeah. Oh, this is not
good. This is a fish in a barrel.
I like Angelina. She came bounding out of the kitchen. Normally, there's like a nice little period where Tom says, who do you think you're cooking against? And the contestant gets out their point, and then Tom says, well, let's see. And then someone comes striding out of the kitchen. Angelina was like bursting out mid-sentence while Jason was still talking. I really like. So their quick fire was, I think, kind of boring, if you will. Mike, do you want to set up what this was, what the challenge was here in Last Chance Kitchen?
Well, boring's the word of the challenge, because they have to go into fridges that are filled with apparently boring, bland ingredients, as Tom puts it, and basically make an awesome dish out of it. But don't worry, they're aided with the help of Soyvay Very Very Teriyaki Sauce for this challenge.
Is this the first Soyvay sponsorship of the Last Chance Kitchen? I haven't noticed it before.
I think so, because I think, and then this is probably the, I don't know, is this greater or less than the Hidden Valley challenge that happened a few episodes ago?
Like, if there's a Ding Mary Kill between Soyvay and Hidden Valley Ranch, and we need something for the third spot.
Glad family of products.
Yeah,
I would, well, I would dig that. But no, I would.
Yikes.
Oh my god.
Come on.
I would kill Hidden Valley Ranch every step of the, you know, any time of day. Like, I'll go, give me Soyvay. I don't know if I'm gonna marry it or ding it, but I would kill the Hidden Valley Ranch. I feel very passionate about this, as you can tell.
Soy vey was invented as a Christmas time tradition. Is that right? I can't really speak to it, but I thought that the combination of Asian flavors with the Jewish culture was a popular thing around Christmas time.
It's Chinese food in the movies for Mike and I on Christmas.
Yeah.
Is that true? Have you ever done that? I've done it.
Not together, but yes.
No. If you've seen the last 5 minutes of A Christmas Story, that's basically what the holidays are.
Yeah, it's great.
They've been the sponsors the last couple of weeks on the online, the webisodes of Last Chance Kitchen. So I was familiar with it coming into the episode. And yeah, nothing wrong with teriyaki.
No, teriyaki's good.
Yeah.
Teriyaki great.
Especially for those from the Pacific Northwest, apparently.
Oh gosh. Here we go.
Pacific Northwest.
Putting teriyaki on my flame broiled durag as I walk around with my leather jacket.
Update your Tumblr.
Yep, update that Tumblr, Mike. Pacific Northwest Tumblr.com. This is, as we talked about, bland, boring, whatever. The teriyaki's there to juice it up. They did use the teriyaki, both of them. I think that it made their dishes pop a little bit. It's interesting to me because usually after the episode on BravoTV.com, they have a blog, usually from a guest judge or somebody that was associated with the episode. For example, last week, Chef Emeril wrote about what he thought about the challenge in general, the elimination challenge last week, and whether or not he felt like Chef Isaac should have been eliminated or should have been on the bottom. That was the subject of his blog. This week, no blog. If you go into the blog section, I kid you not, it's two delicious teriyaki dishes you need in your life by someone named Crystal Puccio. And Crystal basically just provides the recipes from both of the dishes that were cooked in Last Chance Kitchen this week. So soy vey really paid some shekels over here, and it's working out.
I don't feel comfortable with what just happened. But I'm going to keep it to myself.
At any rate, you didn't keep it to yourself because you spoke. So, I don't know. We had shrimp teriyaki with orange and celery leaf salad, corn, onion, and potato. And that was kind of what Angelina was bringing to the table. Jason made salmon teriyaki with broccoli and sweet potato salad and a hard-cooked egg. There weren't really negative comments. Angelina's shrimp was slightly overcooked, but it seemed like a minuscule thing. Tom enjoyed both dishes. But in the end, Jason wins. I don't see Jason dominating his way through Last Chance Kitchen here, which we only have six left, apparently, six Last Chance Kitchen battles left, which means I think there's a good possibility that if a good chef goes home on Restaurant Wars, they could really dominate. Or it could be one of the last one or two chefs eliminated makes their way through Last Chance Kitchen. I don't see Jason having a run in him. Does anybody feel differently?
No.
I think if Philip goes home next week, will Jason make it through? I think he'll unfortunately suffer the same fate of Angelina of one and done.
Yeah, I agree, and I'm rooting for that. Nothing against Jason. I hope you find joy in your life. I hope it's not on LCK, and I hope he's not back on Top Chef, because I really liked what happened last year. Like, last year was the best case scenario that Dougie comes back, and Dougie was the guy who was just who had just gone home very recently. So I hope that it's something very similar to that. That's the only way that LCK really works for me, is if the person who comes back into the competition left very recently, so that it's not too much of a gulf for the viewer between the main show and this little web series that you kind of have to follow in case that person comes back and Chris and Kish is their way to the end. No disrespect to Chris and Kish, who I love tremendously. So that's what I'm rooting for. And I just don't see Jason having the chops to stick around anyway.
Yeah, chops probably are not something that was cooked in ancient times. So, I agree. I don't think he's going to make a run here. Although, as Mike pointed out, or it might have been Kurt, I apologize. He does seem happier here in the Last Chance Kitchen. I'm not sure if it has anything to do with the mustache and beard.
I was going to say, I think it debunked my theory last week of bust people over immediately after getting eliminated, because I don't know how long it takes Jason to grow out facial hair, but at least some time had to have passed for him to come back with the mustache and goatee.
Yeah,
to me, this is looking to me like at least a 2 to 3 week window.
Yeah, I think that that's probably right. And it may be more in line with what we talked about last week, where it's 2 to 3 weeks before the end of the competition, if you will, and they just bring them all in and they start cranking through, or it's even shorter than that. So we don't know, but Jason does look different, that's for sure. The facial hair is in play. And I don't see the run in Jason coming here. But there's so many talented chefs that are left in the competition. It could easily be that no one's going to make a run, and you've got the one person winning, and then the next week the new chef wins, and the week after that, unfortunately, Josh, none of them are actually Dougie. So we're not going to get Dougie coming
back. And we got rid of Big Dougie, so that was the closest analogy.
We were almost there.
What if Jason grows out a full beard, Josh? Are you going to be, and he looks more like Dougie at that point? Still no bueno?
I think he's fine. I think he seems like a good human. You know, I've got nothing against him as a human. And if he has a beard, I'll probably like him even more. I'm a big fan of the beard. But yeah, you know, whatever.
It's all right. Anything else from Last Chance Kitchen or the episode in general?
A good episode for the peanut gallery, I would say. Garrett had a nice little quip where he says Angelina runs like a Giselle. And then there was a conversation where like, oh, Jason's looking nervous, Angelina's have some trouble, and Wesley just says, oh, I think Tom's going to take this one. So always great results from that gallery of characters that now Angelina is joining as well, which will make it even livelier.
I mean, it was such a good cast this season. I think we're seeing through that. You know, I think that just the people that they assembled for Top Chef this season were really fun characters. A lot of them really pop on screen.
I like Wesley tells Angelina that. Making sure that her shrimp isn't undercooked, and she basically sets it on fire, and Grace is like, yeah, that's going to taste terrible.
Yeah, and I really liked at the beginning of the challenge when the chefs were kind of looking into their fridges. Francis got up out of the peanut gallery and started peering over the door of the fridge to look inside.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say as though Francis would have any kind of impact on the challenge by knowing what the ingredients were.
The one kind of thing I did like about the challenge was that they kind of stuck true to the true essence of the refrigerator, and that there was some meat that was in there that was wrapped in white paper and it was not labeled. So they kind of had to unwrap some of the things as one does to be able to actually find out what the protein was.
Those are knickknacks from the Blue Apron recipe someone left behind.
Yeah, there's some ginger in there that I'm not going to use.
So yeah, that was the Last Chance Kitchen. That was the Last Chance to weigh in on the Last Chance Kitchen. I think we're wrapped up here. How about a hashtag? Anybody have any suggestions?
No, Mike.
I was thinking about I have hashtag fancy ants on a log or Valentine's Day or pipe cleaner dreadlocks. But Kurt, you probably have the better suggestions.
I've written down not pipe cleaner dreadlocks. And not banging uglies. I was leaning towards Seattle Crocs myself.
Yeah, I like Seattle Crocs.
Seattle Crocs. So that's the hashtag. If you like what we're doing here, if you have any questions, if you want to let us know through a tweet that you listen to the end of this podcast, you don't have to. But if you'd like to, you can tweet at us using the hashtag Seattle Crocs, C-R-O-C-S, and let us know what you thought of this episode. What your thoughts are now that we're at the halfway plus 0.5 point of the season. Are we? Who do you see as the likely winner or likely loser? You can also let us know, likely loser, next week's eliminated chef that won't make it to Restaurant Wars. You can also let us know in the comments at robhasawebsite.com on the show page for what we do here at Reality Wrap-Ups for this Top Chef episode. If you want to subscribe to the feed for all of the reality TV wrap-ups at Rob Has a Website, you can go to robhasawebsite.com/wrap-ups, R-H-A-P-U-P-S. And you can subscribe to the feed that includes our coverage of Top Chef. It also includes Jordan Parhar's Happy Hour, which is a different topic on reality TV every week. We're covering The Bachelor this season, as well as previous seasons, and The Challenge as well from MTV. So we've got that going in that feed right now. So subscribe if you want. You can always tweet at me. I'm at AC Mazzaro with two Z's and one R. Josh is at Round Howard. Mike is at a Mike Bloom type, even though he is apparently at a Zach Braff type. And Kurt is at Kurt Clark. Anything else to add, everybody?
No, I found my joy again. This was a joyful experience this past hour and a half.
Oh, be joyful. And we'll mark the edits that we need to make in this podcast.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so we'll send that up. Always a great shout out here to Scott St. Pierre. Fantastic Scott St. Pierre, who does great turnaround on these. You have no idea how much Mike Bloom he has to edit out of these things. Mike works... Mike Blue. You work very blue sometimes.
Yeah, I can't wait for the director's cut to be released, which is over 6 hours of profane, written dialogue with just myself.
As Philip.
On the edge of my seat as he brings that in for a landing.
So as always, thank you to Scott St. Pierre, and thank you to everyone for listening and weighing in with your comments and your tweets. Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.